On this June 23rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are some of your Wednesday headlines. The Supreme Court ruling in favor today of a former Pennsylvania high school cheerleader who was punished for a profane Snapchat rant. We'll talk to Washington Post reporter Robert Barnes on the ruling and what it means for school districts. A CDC advisory panel saying that there is likely association between some rare cases of heart inflammation in teens and young adults, particularly after receiving their second dose of the COVID vaccine. Now, most of the cases, according to the CDC, appear to be mild, and patients generally recover from the symptoms. Meanwhile, the highly contagious Delta variant likely will become a dominant force in the U.S. in the coming weeks. That warning from Dr. Anthony Fauci. He did so during an interview this morning telling NBC News that the variant has exploded across Great Britain, now accounting for more than 90% of the new cases across that country. Some of the stories shaping Washington today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House with news today that Vice President Kamala Harris heading to the U.S.-Mexico border later this week. It follows some intense criticism from Republicans over her failure to visit the region when she was in Mexico and Guatemala earlier this month. President Biden has given the vice president the task of leading the diplomatic efforts to try to stem the flow of migrants arriving from the southern border. She will be in El Paso, Texas on Friday, accompanied by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. The issue came up today at the White House briefing with Jen Psaki.
First off, the vice president's office just announced that she'll be visiting the border Friday. What can you tell us about the visit? And you have in the past defended the decision not to visit the border by anyone, really, by President Biden or Vice President Harris. So what's behind the sort of change of course?
Sure. First, I think many of you may have seen it, but just to reiterate the specific details, the vice president will travel to El Paso, Texas on Friday. She will be accompanied by Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alan Mayorkas. Earlier this year, as you all know, the president asked the vice president to oversee our diplomatic efforts to address the root causes of migration from El Salvador to Guatemala and Honduras. And as a part of this work, she recently traveled to Guatemala and Mexico last month to have those discussions. And this trip to the border on Friday will be a part of this effort. I will note that I've also said here from this podium, and she has also said, that when it was the right time, she may go to visit the border. And so this trip on Friday, which is being done in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Mayorkas is, of course, joining her on this trip. And the planning and timing of it was done in coordination with them, is part of the coordinated effort between her office, her work, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Health and Human Services, to continue to address the root causes and work in coordination to get the situation under control.
That from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Now, the vice president's border visit does come just days before former President Donald Trump is also set to travel to the area at the invitation of the Texas governor. Greg Abbott and a group of House Republicans will be joining the former president. He did release a statement claiming that if he wasn't going there next week, she, the vice president, would have never gone. The decisions continue from the U.S. Supreme Court today in an 8-1 ruling, the court ruling that a school district in Pennsylvania violated the First Amendment rights when they punished a cheerleader for swearing on Snapchat. Back in 2017, the high school freshman posting on her page using the F word because she did not make the varsity cheerleading squad. On what has been a busy day of decisions for the Supreme Court, Robert Barnes of The Washington Post explains.
Well, this is a cheerleader who got basically suspended from the cheerleading squad at her high school because she sent out a profane Snapchat complaining that she didn't make the varsity team. And it went just to some friends. It was made off campus, and it was like Snapchats do, supposed to disappear after a while. But instead, she was suspended. And what the court said today is that the school district went too far, that punishment was too severe and violated her First Amendment rights.
Brandy Levy is now an 18-year-old college student, but I'm curious why this particular case made its way all the way to the Supreme Court.
Well, it is kind of a curious case, and from the outside it would seem not to mean that much, but it brought a lot of important issues to the court, such as speech that occurs off campus and speech that occurs online. And exactly sort of what the rules are for schools to discipline students like that. As Justice Breyer, who wrote the opinion, wrote, it's tempting to dismiss her words as unworthy of robust First Amendment protection, but sometimes it's necessary to protect the superfluous in order to preserve the necessary.
One of the cases cited, a case that we featured here on C-SPAN in our Landmark Cases series, was the 1969 Tinker decision, which you write about in your piece today. Can you explain?
Right. That was the decision that said students and teachers don't leave their First Amendment rights at the courthouse door. But it also said that schools do have some role in policing speech in order to keep it from being disruptive to the learning environment. You know, one interesting thing about this decision is it's the first time since that decision that the court has ruled for a student in one of these cases. All of the other decisions, and there haven't been that many, but there have been a few, all were on behalf of the school boards and school principals saying that they could limit speech, for instance, lewd speech at a school activity or speech that seemed to be glorifying drug use. And so one significant thing about this one is that the student actually won.
We are talking with Robert Barnes. He covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. The lone dissent came from Justice Clarence Thomas. What was his argument?
Well, his argument that was that schools historically have been able to police this kind of activity, this kind of speech, and that the majority didn't deal enough with that history. Justice Thomas in the past has been sort of dismissive of the speech rights of students, public school students, saying that the schools have a lot of control over those students once they're sort of within the school's gambit. You know, an interesting thing about this one was that it wasn't on school grounds. The speech occurred off campus, in fact, at a convenience store where Brandy Levi and her friend were tapping out their frustration about cheerleading and softball.
Let me follow up on two other fronts. First of all, what pending cases are we still expecting?
The court is sort of making its way through the rest of its docket and has done a lot of its big cases. There is a big voting rights case that is still out there, and that's one that might really divide the justices, especially right now when there is so much attention being focused on states and their laws that seem to restrict voting rights in some places. This case happens to be from Arizona.
And as you mentioned, Justice Stephen Breyer writing the 11-page majority opinion, a lot of speculation on whether he would retire or there could be other retirements. Historically, if that were to happen, when would it happen?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag when justices decide to announce their retirements. A couple of the recent ones, Justice Stevens and Justice Souter, they announced their retirements after oral arguments were completed. So that was in May. Justice Kennedy announced his on the last day of the term. And so it's really up to the justice when he or she decides to do that. Obviously, with Justice Breyer, there's been a lot of speculation. Everyone is going to be watching next week when the court is supposed to end its work.
And we will be looking for reporting in The Washington Post and online. Robert Barnes, he covers the Supreme Court. As always, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Now to the ongoing negotiations over infrastructure. President Biden's ambitions for a large-scale investment in the nation's aging public works system, along with other parts of his economic agenda, hinge on what has always been one of the most difficult problems for members of Congress, how to pay for it. The New York Times is reporting that question, quote, has sent a group of centrist senators looking for ways to find creative ways to cover nearly $600 billion in new spending that they want to include as part of a potential compromise plan to invest in roads, broadband internet, electric utilities, and other federal infrastructure projects. The full story is available at nytimes.com. Earlier today, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders telling Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC that raising taxes on the rich must be on the table.
I think every member of the caucus and almost all Americans understand that today we are living in a society where the very, very rich are getting phenomenally richer. Jeff Bezos is worth $200 billion. One person. Meanwhile, the working class of this country is struggling. You got 600,000 people who are homeless. You got parents who cannot afford child care. And on top of all of that, we have to deal with the climate crisis, which I think every scientist is telling us is going to be devastating for this country and the entire planet. And we got to invest in transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy and energy efficiency. So we have an enormous amount of work to be done. And at a time when the very rich and large corporations are often not paying anything or very little in taxes, yeah, they're going to have to pay their fair share so that we can protect working families in this country and deal with climate change.
That from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He was on MSNBC earlier today, and joining us on the phone from Capitol Hill, Alex Bolton. He covers the Senate for TheHill.com. Senator Sanders' plan does come with a very big price tag. So where is his plan? Where is infrastructure in general?
Well, infrastructure is moving on two tracks. As you know, there is a group of bipartisan senators. It's 11 Republicans, 10 Democrats, who are meeting with at least a subset of that group is meeting with senior White House officials to discuss a possible compromise. But those talks kind of bogged down on Tuesday. The White House is drawing a line in the sand, and there's some proposed pay-fors that the Republicans are pushing that the White House just isn't buying. So that's kind of slowing down. And then the other track is the reconciliation package, which Chairman Sanders is talking about. He has jurisdiction over it as chairman of the Budget Committee. Now, that would the assumption is that would pass with only Democratic votes through the budget reconciliation process. You need all 50 Democrats on board. And what Sanders has proposed initially is a $6 trillion package, or at least that's the sum total of all the options he's putting on the table. Really hard to imagine that all 50 Democrats are going to support that. And in the meantime, that package isn't moving because some of the key moderates, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, Mark Warner of Virginia, John Tester of Montana, they're involved in this, you know, kind of endless negotiation with the Republican moderates and the White House. So where is infrastructure right now? It's in process. How close are we to any sort of deal or actual legislative, you know, concrete legislative proposals? We're still quite a ways away from that.
Let me turn to another issue. No surprises late yesterday on S1, the voting rights bill that is being proposed by congressional Democrats. Any after effects of that vote yesterday? What are you hearing from Democrats and Republicans today on the Hill?
Well, Senator Jeff Merkley, who is the lead sponsor of the For the People Act, he says that this is going to come back to the floor. And this is not the end of the fight. It's just the beginning, and there are going to be multiple votes on this. Now, what the exact strategy is going to be hasn't yet been formulated. I think what Democrats are talking about is maybe, you know, pulling out certain pieces of that bill and voting on, you know, more discreet packages, smaller bites of the apple. And although it's not clear at all that that can get the 10 Republican votes it needs to overcome a filibuster. Now, one key development is that Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's a prominent moderate, says that, you know, she supports the Voting Rights Act, so the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which would be more focused on poll access issues, in particular, you know, safeguarding, you know, minority voters from interference in terms of getting to the polls. But that legislation hasn't even been introduced yet. It was introduced in the last Congress, but it has yet to be drafted for this Congress. So that's still a ways away. And even there, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to get 10 Republican votes to overcome a filibuster in the Senate, because what the Republicans claim is that the Democrats are, you know, are trying to get aggressive with this legislation and go beyond, you know, previous iterations of the Voting Rights Act. So that's also in limbo. But as far as immediate next steps, I think you can see progressives led by Merkley pressuring Democratic leadership to bring legislation or related legislation back to the floor for votes.
And based on your reporting and your colleagues at TheHill.com, all of this frustrating, maybe even angering progressive Democrats.
Yeah, progressive Democrats are running out of patience. And some of them now are saying, look, maybe we need to cancel the August recess, or at least part of it, because right now we're way behind. And these bipartisan talks on infrastructure, for instance, initially had a deadline of Memorial Day. We're well past that. And the talks keep on going. And right now there's not really much of a consensus as to what the budget resolution is going to look like. Not even all Democratic members of the Budget Committee have agreed exactly on what the budget resolution looks like. So there's still a lot of work to go. And, you know, we're already halfway through the year. So I think Democrats in particular, are getting nervous. And I think Republicans aren't really in a rush to, you know, pass any of Joe Biden's agenda.
Alex Bolton, he is joining us from the Senate Press Gallery on this Wednesday. His work available at TheHill.com. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And one other follow-up from our conversation with Alex Bolton. Yesterday's failure by the Senate to move ahead on that Democratic-led voting bill called the For the People's Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Among the issues that the House Democratic Caucus Chair, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, talked about at his weekly news conference.
Well, we want to continue to move forward to protect and defend the right to vote in America. And that's going to take two forms. The For the People Act, H.R. 1, as well as H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And it's extraordinary to me that the Senate is becoming an institution because of the Republicans that is primarily concerned with defending the status quo on behalf of the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, and undermining our democracy. And the Senate's going to have to work out how to deal with some of the procedural obstacles to progress. But the word filibuster does not appear in the United States Constitution, and they're going to have to take a look at how to proceed. And I know those conversations are underway. With respect to H.R. 4, the Supreme Court was very clear in striking down portions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County versus Holder decision in terms of what it thought Congress should do in order to make the Voting Rights Act whole. And so we're following that process, which involves a series of hearings and testimony that we receive and reports ultimately that are compiled. That process will be underway over the next few months, and I expect that at some point in the fall, we'll pass H.R. 4, send it over to the Senate, and hopefully the Senate, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, can get their act together in terms of defending and protecting the right to vote, which is fundamental to our democracy. And voter suppression for the Republicans is a way of life. It's a strategy. They are worshiping at the altar of voter suppression. That's a disgrace. And we're going to have to do something about it, and we will.
With that, from New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. He, of course, is the chair of the House Democratic Caucus. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 71 points. The S&P was off by nearly 5, and the NASDAQ rose 18.5. Warren Buffett announcing today he will be donating $4.1 billion worth of Berkshire Hathaway shares to 5 foundations, also announcing he will officially resign as a trustee to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This year's donation marking the halfway point for the 90-year-old billionaire. Back in 2006, he pledged to give away all of his Berkshire shares through annual gifts to various charitable groups. Meanwhile, the chairman of Comcast, Brian Roberts, exploring new options for the company's push into streaming, raising the idea of a possible tie-up with the Viacom CBS or the acquisition of Roku. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that, quote, Roberts, who built a colossus branching out from cable and broadband into entertainment with the acquisition of NBC Universal a decade ago, now he has to prove that the company is equipped to compete amid a dramatic industry shift to streaming. The full story at WSJ.com. And here in Washington, D.C., a collision causing a pedestrian bridge to collapse onto D.C.'s 295 in the northeast quadrant of Washington, leaving at least five people injured, trapping a truck that continues to leak gallons of diesel fuel. Those injured were in their vehicles. They're not considered to be life-threatening. However, the accident will mean another traffic bottleneck here in our nation's capital. That portion of 295 expected to be closed at least through tomorrow so officials can reconstruct the crash and clean up the wreckage. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday. Here are some of your other headlines. The White House forcing out the head of the U.S. Border Patrol, Rodney Scott, clearing a path for a leadership change in an agency that has been dealing with a 20-year high in illegal border crossings. In a published statement on social media, Rodney Scott said that he had received a letter offering him the option to resign, retire, or relocate. Last year, he was seen alongside President Trump supporting the border policies of the Trump administration. And in New York City, Eric Adams leading that Democratic mayoral primary. However, it could take weeks to declare a winner under what is the new ranked choice voting system. President Biden today launching a crime prevention strategy, a push to take on the issue of rising gun violence, especially in America's inner cities. Republicans blaming the rise in crime on calls from progressive Democrats to cut police funding. The administration, among other things, outlining what it is calling a zero-tolerance policy for those so-called rogue gun dealers, as well as plans to stop the illegal trafficking of firearms. The announcement late today from the White House. Here's President Biden.
We just met, as I said, with a bipartisan group of mayors, law enforcement, and community leaders. And we discussed a comprehensive strategy that I'm releasing today to combat the epidemic of gun violence and other violent crime that we've been seeing in our country for far too long, that has spiked since the start of the pandemic over a year ago. Crime is historically rises during the summer. And as we emerge from this pandemic, with the country opening back up again, the traditional summer spike may even be more pronounced than it usually would be. For folks at home, here's what you need to know. I've been at this a long time, and there are things we know that work that reduce gun violence and violent crime, and things that we don't know about. But things we know about, background checks for purchasing a firearm are important. Ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. No one needs to have a weapon that can fire over 30, 40, 50, even up to 100 rounds, unless you think the deer wearing Kevlar vests or something. Community policing and programs that keep neighborhoods safe and keep folks out of trouble. These efforts work. They save lives. But over time, these policies were gutted and woefully underfunded. In our conversation today, we talked about our strategy to supercharge what works while we continue to push the Congress to act on sensible gun violence legislation.
The president is also emphasizing that cities and states can use a portion of the $350 billion in direct aid from the COVID-19 rescue plan approved by Congress back in March to be used for public safety efforts. That includes the hiring of more police officers if those communities deem it necessary. Joining the president from the White House, Attorney General Merrick Garland.
First, we will hold gun dealers that break the rules accountable for their actions. Most federally licensed firearms dealers operate legally in selling guns to individuals who have passed background checks. But those dealers that willfully violate the law increase the risk that guns will fall into the wrong hands. Absent extraordinary circumstances, ATF will initiate proceedings to revoke the licenses of dealers that willfully violate the law by failing to conduct required background checks, falsifying records, failing to respond to trace requests, refusing to permit ATF to conduct inspections, or transferring firearms to persons who are prohibited from owning them. Second, we are seeking funding to increase ATF's dealer inspection capacity and improve its effectiveness. ATF has very limited inspection resources. The President's fiscal 2022 budget requests resources to add inspection positions in every field division. The effectiveness of the enforcement program depends on the ability to identify and focus on those dealers that pose the greatest risk to public safety. Starting today, ATF will make clear to investigators in every field division that, as they prioritize inspections, they must consider the extent to which firearms sold by a dealer are later used in criminal activity. Third, we will improve information sharing with state, local, tribal, and territorial partners to help bring more intelligence and law enforcement resources to bear, as well as with the public, to increase our own accountability. Today, ATF has a point of contact in every field division to receive information from mayors, police chiefs, and other local leaders about firearms dealers they believe are acting unlawfully. And starting next month, ATF will begin sharing inspection data with the 16 states that license or regulate firearms dealers themselves. Also beginning next month, ATF will publicly post information about inspection frequency and outcomes disaggregated by field division, providing for enhanced transparency and accountability. Fourth, we are launching a concerted effort to crack down on gun traffickers. Yesterday, the department announced that it will establish 5 new cross-jurisdictional law enforcement strike forces within the next 30 days. The strike forces will focus on addressing significant firearms trafficking corridors that fuel violence in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, and Washington, D.C., as well as in cities and towns along the way. The Justice Department's violent crime reduction strategy and our initiatives to stem the rising tide of illegal guns will save lives.
With more in today's White House announcement, we're joined on the phone with Todd Ruger. He is covering the story for CQ Roll Call. Let me begin specifically with this zero tolerance policy through the Justice Department. Specifically, what does that mean and how is it enforced?
Okay, well, I think that this policy really underscores the difficulty of addressing gun violence on a national scale, because the cause of violence differs from one place to another. Most of this enforcement is done by local law enforcement. So what the Biden administration and the Justice Department are doing here is trying to crack down under the current laws that exist where they can. And one of those things is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. They regulate all of the gun dealers, the licensed firearm dealers. And what they're going to go do is go after dealers who willfully violate gun laws. And those types of violations would be selling to someone who is prohibited from possessing a gun, such as a previous felon, or failing to do a background check on gun purchasers, or falsifying some gun records. And that's really going to focus on keeping guns out of the hands of people that might commit violent crimes with them. Along with that, they're going to focus. They've got limited resources. They've asked for more money in the fiscal 2020 budget, but they've got limited resources, and they're going to focus on inspecting those gun dealers who need it the most. And they're going to use data to try to analyze that, but they're also going to reach out and establish connections with local communities, local leaders, and law enforcement to try to figure out which licensed dealers might be the problem.
Violent crimes have been on the rise the last couple of months. In fact, as you point out, homicides in the first 3 months of this year up 24% higher than the same period last year. My question is why?
Well, I think a lot of people are trying to figure that out. The FBI Director Christopher Wray was on the Hill today testifying, got the same question. And there's a lot of different causes that can happen. One of the things that the Biden administration has been working on is getting community-based gun violence intervention programs out there, where these are the people that are on the streets working, you know, right when gun violence happens to try to defuse situations. They go to the hospital, but they need money to try to keep these operations going. So Biden has asked for more money to try to get more of these people on the streets that can really know on a street by street level what's causing it and what can help de-escalate the violence.
And one final point, because the president's specifically saying to communities there is money to hire more police officers, that really has been a political issue between Democrats and Republicans. Calls by some Republicans that the Democrats want to, quote, defund the police.
Right. One of the things that the Biden administration is announcing and has previously announced is that some of the coronavirus relief funds that these cities are getting can now be used to either hire police officers who are directly related to trying to quell some of this violence that has cropped up during the coronavirus era here, or to fund some of these community-based violence intervention groups. And so, yeah, it's been a political issue, but it seems like on both sides there is some urgency to try to address this. Republicans have been criticizing the Biden administration for the rising crime, and this is the Biden administration's response. And what they've said is we're going to go in these five major directions. Once again, though, some of what the Biden administration will say is that what would really help are stricter gun laws. But those gun bills so far, such as H.R. 8, which would require background checks of all sales, it would close the so-called gun show loophole, passed the House, but has yet to get a vote in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer of New York has said that will get a vote in the Senate, but we haven't exactly seen when. So the Biden administration, without any help from Congress, is forced to try to find new ways to react to this rising gun crime.
The story available tonight at rollcall.com. Todd Ruger here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
In other news on this Wednesday, some new numbers from the FBI indicating the threat facing the men and women in blue. A total of 37 officers have been murdered in the first 5 months of 2021. That compares to 46 during all of 2020. The issue came up at the Senate Appropriations Committee hearing earlier today. Here is FBI Director Chris Wray.
It's also happening despite the troubling upsurge in attacks against law enforcement officers throughout the country. So far this year, the number of officers murdered on the job is far surpassing last year's pace, and it's about 2 officers murdered per week. Tragically, that includes the loss of 2 members of the FBI family, as Senator Moran mentioned, Special Agents Laura Schwarzenberg and Dan Alfin, both shot and killed down near Miami in February. And we honor Dan and Laura's memory every day through our work which has unfortunately not gotten any easier given the diverse array of threats we face as a country.
At today's Senate hearing, the FBI director also pleading with public companies and other hacking victims to avoid paying ransom, saying he fears it will only embolden cyber criminals to ramp up future attacks. The Justice Department disclosing it managed to help the Colonial Pipeline Company recover more than $2 million in cryptocurrency ransom that it paid to the hackers, an attack that did lead to widespread shortages of gas stations here on the East Coast. The FBI able to recover those funds in part because it had a private key that it was able to use to unlock a Bitcoin wallet holding most of the money. However, it remains unclear how the FBI managed to access that key. At another congressional hearing today, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin responding to questions from Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz on the military and the issue of critical race. The theory is a term used by conservatives to claim that liberals espouse the belief that America is fundamentally racist. It came up at today's House Armed Services Committee. Here is that exchange.
In my previous discussions with service members and particularly officers, I would hear about complaints over parts not arriving on time, long deployments, and in my more recent discussions with those officers, the number one issue that they raised to me with concern, often unable to speak publicly for fear of the type of retribution that Lieutenant Colonel Lohmeyer faced, they say that your stand down regarding extremism did not help our military it hurt the military. And I want to share with you that perspective, that it caused service members to otherize one another. It impaired group cohesion. And interesting to me is that I've heard those sentiments most frequently from units that are majority-minority, that this was not particularly helpful. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe share with us more specificity regarding the definitions that seemed to be a challenge when Ms. Hartzler was asking questions. How should the Department of Defense think about critical race theory?
Could I make a comment, Secretary? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm very limited on my time, General Milley.
Well, I just want to make a comment. That the feedback
I've asked the question to Secretary Austin.
I don't know what the issue of critical race theory is and what the relevance here in with the department. We do not teach critical race theory. We don't embrace critical race theory. And I think that's a spurious conversation. And so we are focused on extremist behaviors and not ideology, not people's thoughts, not people's political orientation. Behaviors is what we're focused on. And one final point, and thanks for your anecdotal input, but I would say that I have gotten 10 times that amount of input, 50 times that amount of input on the other side that have said, hey, we're glad to have had the ability to have a conversation with ourselves and with our leadership. And that's what we need to make sure
that we remain a cohesive organization. Again, reclaiming my time, Mr. Secretary, it may be that you're receiving that input in the ratios you describe because it was your directive. It may be that people are concerned about criticizing your decision because Lieutenant Colonel Lohmeyer was not relieved of his command for his actions. He was not relieved of his command because of poor performance regarding his duties. He was relieved of his command precisely because of his thoughts and because of his critique of critical race theory. It is particularly helpful that you have said that the Department of Defense does not embrace critical race theory and that you think the discussion is not appropriate. I would suggest that it is the ideology that is not appropriate.
That from Congressman Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Also, he was joined by the chair of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, giving his own defense of open-mindedness within the ranks during the House Armed Services hearing. He told lawmakers he is offended at claims that efforts to undercut the military's mission and effectiveness are in place. We're going to begin with questions from Democratic Congressman Chrissy Houlihan.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today. I know my time is very precious, but I would like to yield some of my time to General Milley because I know that he had some comments that he wanted to make when Representative Gaetz was talking, as well as Mr. Waltz, about a similar subject of the stand down and race theory. Would you like a minute or so to comment on that? Do you remember what your line of questioning or thought was there?
Sure. First of all, on the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university, and it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out. I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it. I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx. I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend? And I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military, our general officers, our commissioned, non-commissioned officers of being, quote, woke or something else because we're studying some theories that are out there. That was started at Harvard Law School years ago, and it proposed that there were laws in the United States, antebellum laws prior to the Civil War, that led to a power differential with African Americans that were three-quarters of a human being when this country was formed. And then we had a Civil War and Emancipation Proclamation to change it, and we brought it up to the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It took another 100 years to change that. So look it, I do want to know, and I respect your service, and you and I are both Green Berets, but I want to know. And it matters to our military and the discipline and cohesion of this military. And I thank you for the opportunity to make a comment on that.
Thank you, General.
That from General Mark Milley. He, of course, is the chair of the Joint Chiefs, testifying before the House Armed Services Committee. It's available on our website at cspan.org. There was another exchange, this with Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, on the withdrawal of our forces from Afghanistan. She says while the enemy is advancing, we'll begin with Representative Cheney.
General Milley, I wanted to ask you about Afghanistan. You know, it does seem that we've now seen the Taliban taking 50 to 60 more districts. I know the government moves its district centers at some point, but it does seem that we're withdrawing from the battlefield as our enemy advances. So could you talk about both what the actual specifics are? We haven't really heard anything in terms of over-the-horizon basing and whether or not you think this is good policy to withdraw as our enemy is advancing.
Congresswoman, in terms of the district centers in the provinces, and it was mentioned earlier, there's 419 district centers, 81 of them or so are in the hands of the Taliban. About 50 were done previously, and about 30 or 40 in the last X amount of months. In addition to that, no provinces have fallen to the Taliban yet. There's a 300,000 plus or minus security force consisting of the army and the police forces for the Afghans. We have not done train, advise, assist in quite some time down at the tactical level. So they have been out there shouldering the burden of that fight for well over a year. And in terms of what we are doing is a deliberate, responsible drawdown, a retrograde, to bring out U.S. military forces. And we're going to keep a small number of forces there to maintain the embassy open and to keep capabilities there and keep the money going for the ANSF and the government. Now, what happens in the future? There's a wide variety of possibilities. Worst case, civil war, breakdown, fracturing the government, fracturing of the army, that's very possible, and that would be a very bad outcome. There's also a possibility, not high on the probability list, but a negotiated settlement between the government and the Taliban, that's possible. And then the alternative is an outright takeover of the Taliban, which I also think that is unlikely but possible. So there's a variety of outcomes here that could happen. We are executing the orders that were given in a very professional way, and thus far, things are relatively stable on our end.
Thank you, General Milley. I think it's obviously just a significant concern as we do watch the Taliban advance, and we know we've got a counterterrorism mission we have to conduct, and we don't have any basing agreements secured for over the horizon.
That from Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, and today's House Armed Services Committee, and the testimony of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Finally, today's funeral for the late Senator John Warner, the Republican lawmaker representing Virginia for five terms. Today, President Biden honoring his life, acknowledging that they come from different parties, the president praising Senator Warner's ability to reach across the political aisle. His remarks at Washington's National Cathedral.
While we represented different political parties, I can say without hesitation, John was a man of conscience, character, and honor, with a deep commitment to God and country. Enlisted in the Navy, in the United States Navy, at age 17 to fight in World War II. A few years later, enlisted in the Marine Corps to fight in Korea. Eventually named Secretary of the Navy by President Nixon, then elected to the United States Senate, where he became a towering and respected voice on foreign policy, national security, and defense, the second longest serving senator from Virginia and the longest serving Republican. A member of the greatest generation, and as that, he understood that democracy is more than a form of government. Democracy is a way of being. He understood it begins and grows in an open heart and with a willingness to work across the aisle and come together in common cause. And that empathy is the fuel of democracy.
That eulogy from President Joe Biden, today's funeral mass for the late Senator John Warner. He died last month at the age of 94. This program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. And check out all of C-SPAN's coverage online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington for the Wednesday edition, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.